Welcome to the Animal Guide for Curious Humans, the podcast that explores the vast world of non-human animals and our relationship to them. I'm your host, Maureen Armstrong. For more information, please visit us at theanimalguide.com. Hi there, folks. Welcome to another episode of the Animal Guide for Curious Humans. Today, we are exploring the healing power of connecting with animals. You've probably heard of programs in hospitals and nursing homes where animals, typically dogs, are brought in to interact with patients. Some dogs are also employed at airports to help reduce anxiety in passengers who are afraid to fly. Several studies have shown that human-animal engagement can be highly beneficial for many people and can help combat depression, anxiety, even loneliness. But human-animal interaction can also be a form of therapy for those dealing with significant trauma, such as PTSD. What we don't talk about as frequently is that the benefits of interaction can be just as transformative for animals who have experienced trauma as it is for people. Our guest today is Dr. Jeannie Joseph. She's the executive director of the Human-Animal Connection, an American-based nonprofit organization dedicated to changing the way humanity relates to animals. As she says it, her organization brings people and therapy animals together for the benefit of both. They offer a variety of therapy programs, including free therapy dog visits to veterans, active duty personnel, healthcare providers, and other vocations where people are in service to others and can experience trauma as a result of their work. They also provide several educational classes and Zoom sessions to help people deepen their connection to animals, increase empathy, and to facilitate cross-species communication. One such program is called Canines Teach Compassion. It's offered to high school students and combines social skills and resilience training with animal interaction. Jeannie is an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, an author, dog trainer, and a consultant on relationships between people and animals. And as you will hear, she's a very dynamic speaker. She is the creator of the ACT Resilient Method of Therapy, which combines various therapeutic exercises with therapy animal engagement to improve morale and well-being. She wrote a book on the subject called The ACT Resilient Method. She's presented to over 4,000 service members and their families, and for her work, she received the Volunteer Service Award from then-President Barack Obama. Her team at Tripler Army Medical Center in Hawaii was given a national award for workplace resilience from the American Psychological Association. Jeannie's latest endeavor is her new book entitled The Human-Animal Connection, Deepening Relationships with Animals and Ourselves. In this episode, Jeannie will discuss the benefits of connection between people and animals for both of them, her work with service personnel, high school students, and rescue animals, her own rescue dog, Sophia, and how we can all improve our interactions with our pets. So here we go with Dr. Jeannie Joseph of the Human-Animal Connection. So Jeannie, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate having you here.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here.
Great. So your organization, the Human-Animal Connection, you offer a number of programs that are really designed to strengthen human-animal interaction and particularly therapeutic interaction. Designed really to help alleviate the effects of trauma experienced by people and by animals. And I love how you put an emphasis on the fact that the interaction is mutually beneficial. So the questions that arise for me about that is, from the human perspective, can you tell us more about how interaction with animals is in fact healing and can be healing? What are some of the emotional, physiological benefits to it? And then equally from the animal's perspective, how can interaction with humans be therapeutic?
Yes. Well, we have worked with over 4,000 service members, veterans, and their families. And what I saw, the work I was doing with them was already very effective. But when I brought the therapy animals, what I saw a dog could do in 10 minutes was just amazing. I thought, why am I working so hard when this dog can just come in and get this person who's completely shut down, completely like the heart is like underground, and this animal comes in and just, opens them up and brings them into present time. And it's amazing because animals don't judge us. They don't care what kind of car we drive or, what we've done with our life or not done with our life. They're just looking at our essence. And it's an amazing sensation to be really seen as who you are beyond your pain, beyond your story, beyond whatever is going on, injuries or whatever. The animal just relates to you as a being. And if you're a person who shares your life with a dog, that they have very strong opinions about who they like and who they don't like. Like there are certain people that they just want to get to know, and they just have to sniff and touch and look and cuddle. And other people are like, okay, I don't need to talk to you. I mean, they are operating at a very fine-tuned level of awareness and recognition of our nature. And dogs in particular, because they have been sort of bred to cohabitate with humanity, have gotten very, very good at reading our emotions. And so they can sense how we're feeling and what we need in that moment. And it's a very powerful thing. And, if we were doing this show 10 years ago, what I'd be saying might be a little out there, but now the research is really starting to come into play, and we're starting to see that just 20 minutes of interacting with a therapy animal can increase hormones, brain chemistry like oxytocin, serotonin, the feel-good chemicals that, women have when they're breastfeeding. And not only is it true for the human, but we're beginning to understand that it's also true for the animal. So when the animal has a loving interaction with us, they get the benefit just as we get the benefit. And as you mentioned in your intro there, we're very interested in making sure that the interaction is mutually beneficial. We don't want to use animals as tools of therapy. We want to make sure that they are getting as much or more as we are from the interaction. And that means that in our work, we teach the humans how to be very attentive to when the animal is showing signs of stress or fatigue or, in especially animals working in high stress emotional situations like disaster response or after school shootings or things like this. They can pick up the energy of the humans. They can kind of take it on, and that is their gift, but it's also their curse. You know what I mean? Because they can get overwhelmed by our emotions, and we need to really be observant of them, make sure they don't work for more than an hour in that kind of a situation for most dogs, and make sure that they de-stress afterwards. So de-stressing, if you're working with a therapy dog, you want to understand what they're both what triggers them, but also what de-stresses them. For some, it might be just running around the yard and playing with a toy. For others, it might be cuddling. For others, it might be not engaging, having some quiet time. And so when you understand the animal that you're working with, their strategy, you can make sure that they get that de-stress time after an interaction that's intense.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. How so? The first time you referenced the first time, particularly when you were working with sort of veterans and service personnel, and I want to ask you some more about that later. But what prompted you to bring a dog into the work that you were doing with them? How were you confident that you thought that was going to be an added benefit to the work you were already doing with those personnel?
Well, it was somewhat accidental in the sense that I didn't know how powerful it was going to be. I thought it would be good, but I had no idea how good. And who taught me was a rescue dog. I was living in Hawaii at the time, volunteering at the shelter. There was a dog there, and this was, 20 years ago or something. So this was a high-kill shelter, unfortunately. They do the best that they can, but it was a small shelter. And this dog had been there a long time, and he was on the you-know-what list, the E list. And he was a pit bull and older, 7 years old, not a pretty, fluffy little white thing, but, a brown pity. And he had scars all over his body. He was missing teeth because he was actually, I call him a prisoner of war. He had been forced to be a wild boar hunter. They do that in some parts of Hawaii where they will starve the dogs to make them more more aggressive and, you know, oh, it's just awful, right? I won't tell you too many horrible things. But anyway, the short version is he was the sweetest dog I have ever met. And I've met lots and lots of dogs. And he was, I mean, everybody says that, but he was just, he had the ability to read a group. So I would take him into the hospital and sitting with a group of soldiers sitting in a circle. These were soldiers hospitalized with PTSD. So we're not just talking about a little bit of PTSD. You know, wow. These people who really were, you know, in trouble. And he would go around, he would say hello to each one. He could tell if someone was afraid of dogs and he would just pass them up. And but he would just do what we call an alert, which is he would find one person who was really in trouble in that moment, you know, was really suicidal. And he would do an alert. He would sit right in front of that person and just look them in the eye until they melted. And he would look and look and look. And, you know, at first they're like, oh, dog, wow. And then it was like, okay, all right. I mean, then it's like pretty soon they're touching. And then, you know, 3 minutes later, they're on the floor on their belly, rubbing the dog's belly, you know, just cuddling and making baby talk and giggling. And the whole room just changes because they see this dog select this person that intuitively they also could sense this person's, you know, really having a rough time. And nobody knew how to talk to that person or what they, you know, words don't help sometimes, you know, sometimes you just need pure love. And so Oscar, that was his name. I gave him, that wasn't a shelter name. He had a terrible shelter name, but I gave him the name Oscar when I adopted him because I was in the movie business. So it meant something to me. Right. So he would just love up these, you know, love up this person and to be chosen by a dog, you know, yeah, he was nice to everyone. Everyone got a moment to say hi and pet, but he would pick the person who was his person for that session. And that was it. And it not only benefited the person who was chosen, but everybody could see that the dog saw something and the dog connected to something. And the person who was chosen, it's very, very powerful. And we see that in the high school, in our high school program too. We have a high school program called Canines Teach Compassion. And we bring the therapy dogs in. But not just to let them cuddle and pet, which we do, but we also teach the kids how to do some basic training for therapy dog work. So they learn how to teach the dog some basic skills. And we had one boy who was a freshman, and maybe he had skipped a grade or two because he looked a lot younger than everyone else. And he was maybe about 80 pounds and he didn't talk at all. He just couldn't fit in with the crowd or whatever. He just was really a loner and very, very not talking at all. And we had 130-pound bull mastiff, one of our dogs in the therapy program, who was like almost twice the size of this boy. And this dog just picked him. And therapy dogs are not allowed to lick. That's not something that therapy dogs do. They're trained not to. And this dog does not lick, but he just saw this boy and he started to lick him and lick him. And lick him and lick him. And everybody started laughing and he started laughing because the whole group, you know, the dog's name was Shadow. Shadow had said hello to everyone, but he picked this boy. And there was something so powerful about that for that boy. And after that, he started talking and you couldn't shut him up. He was just, you know, what are we doing next? What's happening today? Why are we doing that? What's happening now? You know, he was just a chatterbox. It was like he'd been saving it, you know, because the experience of really being seen, because this dog said, you are special and I want to connect with you. And everybody else saw that. And so it was like he was on the in crowd now. You know, now he was, everybody else saw there was something special about this boy. And it just changed everything in the group dynamic. So I forgot the question, but
you've covered so much of this, you know, what the potential benefits are and how people are seeing it. And I'm fascinated by, it's not random, but it's the engagement, the relationship may be stronger with one person or one animal than it is with others. And so your story about Oscar, you know, how he connected, or even this Shadow connecting with this one little boy more so maybe than some of the others. When just going back to your story of Oscar and the service folk who are, you know, as you say, if they're hospitalized for PTSD, they're in severe condition. Did the medical practitioners see and recognize what sort of was happening here? How miraculous this was that Oscar was presumably helping to lower their blood pressure, making it easier for them to engage. Did you get that positive feedback from the healthcare practitioners?
Yes. Yeah, and it was amazing because, you know, I don't know the stories, of course, for confidentiality, and I didn't know anything, but they could see, oh my God, you know, they began to pay attention to Oscar's opinion. And they could, in many cases, confirm, yes, in fact, this person was in that state in some cases, but other cases, they were like, okay, we're learning along with Oscar. You know, he's got some pretty good diagnostic tools. Every dog has some ability, but some dogs, I'd say about 20%, just, and that's not a scientific number, that's just my anecdotal number, but about 20% seem to have an extra ability to really read human emotions accurately. So all dogs have some ability in that area, but there's this 20% or so that really are suited. They're like, their life purpose is to help humans. And these dogs, just, they know instantly what's going on. They sense subtle changes, the littlest changes, and I've seen this in horses too. They can sense changes in your breathing, your stress levels. You know, who knows what all their, you know, what all senses are involved for them in terms of getting this information, but they get it. And they know, you know, where someone's at and the nuances of change. So it's not a static reading from the animal that's gifted in this way.
It's extraordinary. I just love this. So you mentioned a little bit about how there is more research being done to help confirm what you see and experience all the time, vis-a-vis the benefits, therapeutic benefits of this connection. Are there any particular, just as examples, you could give us of some of the studies that have been done, and what specifically the positive benefits are? Is it mostly physiological? Is it just the emotional state as described by the person participating in such programs? Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so I mean, Sigmund Freud used to, at the end of his life, worked with his dog in therapy sessions. So it's not exactly brand new, but the research is new. So I think that, for example, there's an organization called HABRI, HABRI, and it's the Human Animal Bond Research Institute. And they have a good website and they have lots of resources. So you can sort of see the latest and greatest. And in the last 10 years or so, there has been so much more. I mean, tons more research than has been in the previous decades. So there's really a huge breakthrough. And so HABRI is one resource. For working with the military, I know your viewers can see this, but I'll show it to you. It's the United States Army Medical Department Journal on Canine Assisted Therapy and Military Medicine. And this is from April to June 2012. So it's pretty early, but this was wonderful for work with combat canines in combat situations, not just for bomb detection, but for emotional support. And then on in the classroom side, there's a book called The Canine Campus Connection, and this is this is purely academic, all the studies and research on how beneficial it is to have dogs in a college environment. So those are
Great.
probably, you know, there's many more, but that'll get you started.
Fantastic. Yeah. And we'll put references to those in the show notes. So if folks want to take a closer look, they can access them from there.
There was one, I just tell you one study because you asked once, but they found that, like, cardiac patients who, you know, after surgery, they didn't want to walk. And if they gave them a choice of, well, you can walk with the aide or you can walk with a dog. Of course, the aide was there too, but the people who had said no to walking with the human aide were willing to walk with the dog. And so that created much more ambulation, which reduced hospital stays and had much more positive outcomes. So there's all kinds of interesting research, you know, in terms of children reading to dogs, improving their reading skills over a 6-week period. It's pretty robust, that research. So yeah, people can look all that up.
That's a great example. You talked a lot about dogs. Which other animal species, in your experience, are well suited to therapy programs?
Yeah, so it's really interesting that almost any animal that you have a bond with can be really an animal that can serve us in this way emotionally. So certainly horses, certainly dogs, certainly cats. But, you know, we do see pigs, we do see goats, we do see llamas, you know, we do see cows. There's a woman in Arizona that does cow cuddling, $75 an hour, and you can cuddle with her therapy cow, and she's booked for 6 months.
Wow.
6 month waiting list. So, you know, so it depends. It's not so much the species, it's the individual. So it's the individual dog, the individual cow, the individual horse. We're working now with a donkey that we are training to become a therapy donkey, and he is just extraordinary. So we do this workshop called On Donkey Time, and we just teach people how to be very, very calm. And what happens is donkeys, they get a bad rap. You know, a lot of people think, oh, donkeys, they're so stupid, they're so stubborn, which is not true. What's true is that donkeys will only do what feels right to them, what feels safe to them, what feels good to them. And so they are never out of step with themselves. Of course, they can be forced. We're not talking about forcing a donkey, but donkeys naturally will gravitate towards what is good and what is safe. And we humans could learn a lot from that. So what we do is we teach the humans how to be very, very peaceful. And what And we're sitting kind of in a circle, but wide gaps so the donkey can move in and out. And we allow the donkey to choose who he wants to interact with. And the humans can see, wow, when I'm peaceful, the donkey wants to come over. And when I start worrying about such and such, the donkey is not interested. And so it becomes very, it's like biofeedback with a donkey. You know, it's like instant calibration, because the instant you relax and the instant you breathe, the donkey goes, oh, okay, I want to kind of smell you and come over to you. You know, the instant, doesn't take like 5 minutes or 5 days. It's the instant that you settle into this, what I call being on donkey time, which is like right here, right now, what feels good. Then the donkey's like, I want some of this.
How do you determine then with your interaction with various animals, you know, dogs that you have in your own family or there that you've worked with a shelter with? How do you ascertain which animals you think are going to be effective as therapeutic animals for this sort of connection? What's that process like?
Yeah. So, you know, this is over time observation. So we have about 100 points, a literal 100 point system of evaluating the potential. And we're looking at the bond, the dog's, you know, interest in bonding with the human. So some dogs are like, I want to look at you. I want to touch you. I want to be near you. If something is scary happening, I'm going to come near you. They have a whole set of behaviors that indicate their interest. A good potential therapy dog wants to meet multiple people and likes multiple touch from strangers and just wants to get to know, very interested in the newness of things. Some dogs are not interested in newness or strangers or new touches or new people or new places. So, you know, that doesn't mean they're bad dogs. It just means that they're not in that category of potential therapy dogs. But even so, occasionally I'm wrong, but not too often. Mostly I have a good sense. I think, you know, I'll go up to people, you know, just walking and say, my God, can you ever, you're interested in therapy dog work? You know, I can just start, I can see it now. You know, I can kind of smell it or something. Not smell it literally, but, you know, I can feel it in my guts that this is a dog that, you know, you just go up to him and it's like you touch him and they're down and, you know, on the ground, rub my belly and you're a complete stranger. You know? So therapy dogs have certain calmness. They have a certain balanced energy. They want interaction and they want to give love. So that's not every dog. As you know, other dogs are very happy to just play with the ball and, you know, want to go for a run. And, you know, they're that, you know, it's like, oh yeah, human. Okay. When's dinner? You know, it's not that they don't have that same kind of interest. The same with people. Not everybody would be a good therapist, right? Some people are great at something else, but other people are just, you know, they care about people and they have the compassion, they have the interest, and they get juice from the interaction. So a therapy dog gets energy from interacting with strangers. And a non-therapy dog is sort of like, okay, I'll interact with you, but what else can I do now? You know?
Right. Do you find that it's similar with, say, horses? That was the first other species of animals that you were referencing.
Yes. Yeah. It's the same thing. You'll see that, you know, that a good therapy horse, very calm, very gentle, and they just, you know, they're willing to look you in the eye. They enjoy eye contact. And eye contact is not a natural thing for all animals, especially prey animals, you know. But when they get sort of, you know, on the wavelength of humans and the idea that humans are good, they want that, they seek it. So a good therapy animal enjoys touch, enjoys contact, enjoys presence, can handle people in different emotional states, and they have their own groundedness so that they become like the stabilizing force. Let's say if you're bringing a child in who's got some emotional issues, the animal is a stabilizing force. They're not bouncing off the wall and jumping all around and being crazy. They are like, I'm here. Go ahead and pet me. I love you. Everything is fine. That's their message.
And despite the fact that in some instances, those animals themselves will have been through quite a bit of trauma, just as you were talking about Oscar having gone through that trauma of being, sort of forcibly used in boar hunting. So they themselves have got all kinds of issues potentially that are affecting their behavior.
Yes. Well, like I believe that animals can experience trauma just as humans can. The difference is that animals have the potential to heal, especially if you have methods that we have 33 methods to help them heal. So we can get them through that. So that has to happen first, obviously. The animal needs that healing period. But I think that having experienced trauma, just like with humans, veterans helping other veterans, that when the human gets through a certain amount of trauma, they are uniquely suited to help someone else. And it's the same thing with an animal who has had trauma but had the opportunity to heal. Like one of my best therapy horses was a horse named Miss Betsy, and she had been forced free, a drug runner. They tie all the horses' legs together so they can't escape. And then when they're finished with them, they just leave them in the barn to die. They just starve them to death. So she was rescued by a sanctuary that I was volunteering with. And I began working with her. In the beginning, like the farmhands had to just throw hay over. They couldn't even get near her because she would kick with all 4 feet anyone just coming close. She was terrified of dogs. She was terrified of everything, actually. And a loner, like the herd wouldn't accept her because she was just. So I began working with her, and she became the most extraordinary healing horse. Like you could just be in her presence and you felt better. She didn't have to do anything. She would look at you and you would just look at her, and somehow something would melt, the walls would come down, and she just had this quality. And she was a very big horse, and she was old. She was actually 27 or something. She was pretty old. So she had, injuries. You couldn't ride her or anything like that because of her injuries, but just being in her presence was transformative.
Hey there, I hope you're enjoying the show. Just a quick reminder that we have lots of show notes and details from the interviews posted on our website, theanimalguide.com. So you can always head over there to get really quick links to the guests on the show, the books that they refer to, studies they refer to, and other great stuff. So I hope you'll do that. If you haven't already subscribed, please do subscribe to the podcast. We really appreciate your support. And if you could, give us a rating on Apple or Stitcher or Spotify, wherever you listen to the podcast, we'd really appreciate that as well. Okay, here we go. Back to the show. I wanted to go back to your reference early on of your work with veterans and service personnel. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and the work you've done with that community of people? I mean, the effects of being in, particularly being in combat, are just so profound. And there's something that most of us can't even fathom. And it has such long-term effects on those folks who are doing that great work. I'd love to hear more about what you've done working with them and various animals.
Yeah, so it began, the earlier incarnation of this work, the human-animal connection, was my program called the ACT Resilient Method that I created, and it used improv comedy, laughter, expressive arts, and then as I began to develop it, working with the therapy animals. So I began to combine that, and that work with the animals it was very effective. We were getting over 80% reduction in symptoms of PTSD. I mean, just amazing transformation. So it was very effective. But like I said, when I brought the animals in, it just took it to a whole nother level, and that just sort of shifted my purpose. So that is the primary focus now of my work. I still do the other work, but this is really front and center. Yeah, so it's really been quite extraordinary, and we won several awards, one from the American Psychological Association, one from President Obama, the Volunteer Service Award from President Obama for that work. And it's really effective because sometimes people want to talk, and that's great, but sometimes people don't want to talk or can't talk. You know, that what hurts is beyond words. And what the animals do is they touch into a place that is really beyond words. Like they touch you in a place that's beyond your story, beyond your experience, and it's just right here, right now. And that brings people into the present moment. And what happens is that it touches the heart, you know, it touches the emotions in a way that talk therapy may not be able to do. Nothing against any other forms of therapy, and they're all good, but sometimes you need something else. Sometimes you need just love, you know, furry love. And, you know, as a therapist, I can't go and cuddle with the soldiers and hug them and hold them, but the dog can. Right? You know, we can't do touch, but touch is a you know, a healing force, and touching and being touched is healing. There's so much that happens in the process of touch that, you know, it's unfortunate that there aren't, you know, therapy animals everywhere in every hospital, in every situation, because they are so effective. And, you know, I have I adopted a rescue. And she was a feral dog when I first got, well, I was volunteering. This was when I first moved to Tucson from Hawaii. So from Hawaii to Tucson, because I
Wow,
was
there's a
volunteering
difference.
at the shelter. Yeah, really. So I had was working at the program at the shelter, working with at-risk kids, teaching them dog training, basic dog training, very effective program. And I just moved here. Had a friend who had a house. I was renting a room in their house, and they had only one rule: no animals. That was their one rule. And of course, I was volunteering in the shelter, and every day I would say, "I'm not taking this one home. I'm not taking that one home. I'm not taking this one home." And I was one day, this little thing. She was about at that time 13 pounds, and she had this huge cone on, and she was being dragged by the shelter worker. She'd come from another shelter and another shelter and another shelter to get to where we were. And she saw me, leapt into my chest with the absolute assumption that I would catch her, which I did. I was standing, she was walking, and she's whoop, and I caught her. And that was it. She had just decided that I was her person. You know, I mean, this is the first time I'd ever seen her. Of course, I couldn't leave her at the shelter after that. So I had to put her in with a foster person that I knew until I could get an apartment, because I didn't have an apartment yet. So she made me get an apartment. And of course, the rest is history. But she was, you know, feral at first. And when I first got her, and I'd take her for walks to the apartment complex, the maintenance men in their uniforms would walk all the way around to avoid us because she was so terrifying. I mean, she was just, you know, a force of nature. She, little 13-pound tiger, you know. And we did this healing work with the human-animal connection methods, and she's now my therapy dog, and she is the sweetest, kindest.
Lucia.
Nobody believes the story when I tell it about her, because she's so sweet and gentle. So people and animals can transform. We are not at the mercy of our trauma or our past if we know the pathway to heal. And that is, of course, the missing ingredient that we want to educate people about, is how healing happens. And the first thing, you know, when we see trauma, when we see people who've been traumatized, they're not here, they're disengaged, they're not in the moment, they don't feel safe at all. And I learned, you know, everything I learned from the human animal connection, I learned from working with the shelter dogs. I mean, they literally taught me everything. I mean, I was a dog trainer. I knew some things, but dog training doesn't teach you any of this stuff. And you know, at first I had all these healing methods, you know, Reiki, energy healing, massage, all these great methods. And at first I thought, oh, I'm going to go in the shelter and I'm going to fix all these traumatized and shy dogs. Well, you know, I had to learn that, you know, that good intention is not enough. That when you're dealing with an animal that's really frightened or traumatized and is, you know, cowering in the corner of their kennel, you know, you just can't go in and start working with them. You know, you have to do this. You have to first establish a sense of safety for that animal, and then begin to develop trust, and then you can do all these great methods, you know.
Sure.
So that's what the animals taught me. So I would go in. Fortunately, I was allowed to go into the kennels, and these are small shelter kennels. And I would go and I would sit as far as I could from that dog, and I would sit very still like a statue. I wouldn't look at the dog, I wouldn't talk to the dog, I wouldn't touch the dog, I wouldn't move towards the dog. I would just be as still as I could and let the dog get used to my presence, my scent, you know, just being there and recognizing that I wasn't a threat. And then what I would do is I would have, you know, some stinky treats like hot dogs or turkey or something with me. And I would offer it up and in an open hand, and I would calibrate. So, okay, the dog's too scared to take the treat from my hand. That's good for me to know. And it helps me to understand, because when they're too stressed, they very wisely won't eat, you know, because their digestive system is not ready to receive food. So this tells me I can calibrate. Okay, you know, 30 minutes later, this dog is ready to take a treat out of my hand, because I've done some of these methods that I'm doing that are very respectful of the animal's pace and timing and rhythm. So I'm going to let the animal approach. And if the animal doesn't approach, what I'm going to do is I'm going to toss a treat, not at their face, but a little to the left or a little to the right of their face. And what that does is it's going to trigger them to move a little. And then we're talking about I'm talking about working now with dogs that are what we call pancake dogs. They're just completely frozen. They don't want to interact. They don't want to treat. They can't engage at all. And of course, when people walk by these dogs in the shelter and they're shaking or they're cowering, they just walk right on by because they don't want to scare the dog, you know. So these dogs get passed up. And if they're in a kill shelter, that, you know, that's what happens. So it's very important to pay attention to the pace of when that animal's ready to not approach, not use my voice, not even use my eyes. And so I'm going to use that tossing of that treat, get them to move their head just a little bit, because movement is the antidote to the frozen response of the fight, flight, or freeze. So movement that they choose, not movement that I impose with a leash or something, but movement that they choose begins to unwind their nervous system. And the next thing is that this is my theory, is that dogs in a shelter environment get, they're very traumatized, but sometimes coming in, but they're going to be traumatized by the shelter environment. There's too much noise, too many scents, and they have no freedom of choice. They can't get away from anything. There's no safety in that shelter environment, sensorily speaking, even though they know it's not a tiger there. So shelters are doing a good job of protecting them from cars and other terrible things, but they don't recognize their emotional needs. And so what happens in the shelter environment is there's too many scents, there's too many sounds, there's too much motion. Their senses get overloaded. And what a healthy dog is going to go nose first. Like, they're going to smell you and get to know you through their nose. And then they're, you know, they'll look and hear too, but the nose is the first method of getting information. But if their noses are overwhelmed, as they are in a shelter environment, the nose starts to shut down. So what I'm going to do by offering the stinky treat, as opposed to just say a milk bone or something that doesn't have as much scent, is that I'm going to be eliciting the nose. So then after the dog has moved just an inch or two with his nose to get that treat, then I'm going to toss the treat a little further so now he has to lean. Next step, he's going to take a step. And pretty soon he's getting used to the idea, oh, Genie is a treat dispenser. Not so bad. You know, because now we've gone through 5 or 6 treats and nothing bad has happened. And pretty soon I'm, you know, the treats are coming closer and closer to me. The dog is getting closer, closer to me, feeling safe. And this is the process that we go through. I mean, that's sort of the shorthand version of it. But what I'm doing is I'm creating me as a safe person, then starts to happen, and then curiosity comes into play, and pretty soon they want to touch. And within usually about 40 minutes, most of them are going to be cuddling with me.
Incredible. And how many? So that's within a 40 minute period, which is amazing. But how many sessions would you typically have with a dog who starts out as a, as you say, a pancake dog before there's sort of longer term, longer lasting real change for that animal?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, some animals will literally have massive turnaround in one session, but generally around 6.
About is it, six?
You know, some six. More, some less, you know, but that would be sort of a ballpark. Volunteering at the shelter here in Tucson, PAC, the municipal shelter, which is, right now has 537 dogs in a shelter built 400. So you can, gives you some idea how intense it is, because they have to, it's a municipal shelter, means they have to take anyone who comes to their door. So there was this one dog, it was a play group. So these dogs are in a play group. It was a fantastic thing. I don't know if you know about Dogs Playing for Life, but they have developed this program where they determine what a dog's play style is, and dogs that have similar play style will play together. So they won't put gentle and dainty dogs in with the rough and rowdy, so they separate them. But anyway, So I was observing, learning, training, taking this training. And there was one dog cowering in the corner. All the other dogs are playing and kind of, rambunctious and all the stuff that they're doing. One little one in the corner. And I began working with him. I was behind the chain link fence. And all I could do is this kind of energy work that I do, this energy healing work. And just basically, it's offering him some calm energy amidst all the chaos of everything going on. And it took him about 15 or 20 minutes to kind of get the courage. And he made a beeline all the way across the yard. And all the other dogs, like, oh my God, what's going on? And they came running over to him, but he made it all the way over to me and right against the chain link fence. So we could kind of feel my hand against the fence. And I was like, okay, I got to work with this dog because he was unable to make any eye contact. He couldn't be touched by anyone because these dogs are evaluated by the behavioralists. And so this was his notes: don't touch, don't look at him. And I began working with him, and it was slow at first, but eventually I began take him out for an ice cream, and he was terrified of everything in the world. And then I began taking him home for little home visits, and he would be in the yard. And what I would do is just let him make his own choices. Like, I'm going to sit here. I'm going to walk over there, the sun. I'm going to get over here. I'm going to walk over there. I'm going to look at this. And about a half an hour of, but he made about 12 choices. And this is very good to get the brain coming unfreezing to just shoot, make choices, which they can't do in the shelter. After that, he was ready for massage. And then he was ready to come into the house and would, meet my other dog. And, began, and then he had like sleepovers, and then pretty soon he was adopted. So that was about a 4 week process of going, twice a week. So every dog's a little different, but I'd say six is kind of a ballpark for the heavy, heavy trauma. Some will turn around in one session.
Incredible. The on the human end of things. So when you have a client or someone comes to you who's requiring support for their trauma, is there a ballpark number of interactions with the dog or other animal that the person will be involved with, or does that vary greatly?
It varies greatly, but I'd say 6 to 10,
Six
six
to
to 10
ten.
sessions. One session is going to create relief. But if you're talking about, because we are also teaching the human, we're teaching them, and we do it the way we teach the human is through the dog. And this is what we do in our Canines Teach Compassion class with the high school, is that we teach them how to recognize stress in the dog. So we look 10 scale. 10 is like the worst. 10 is you're going to get bit. Something bad is going to happen. We never want to be at a 10, but we know it happens. And one is like the dog's laying on the floor. If you make a sudden noise, the dog might open his eye, but go right back to sort of sleeping. So one is a very peaceful state. And this is not like temperament evaluation. This is like where you are in the moment. It's like a weather report in emotional terms. So we teach them to recognize that in the dogs. And then they'll say, what is Sophia right now? And they'll say, she's a three. And then we'll ask them, what is it in her body language that tells you that she's a three? And then what about Bailey? Oh, he's a six. Okay, what do you see in Bailey's body language that tells you he's a six? And within one session, these kids learn, I mean, they are within 1 point of accuracy. I mean, that it's amazing how intuitive this is to really understand this. Sometimes it takes one or two sessions, but they really get it. And then we say, okay, well, that's the same for you. You have the same scale of 10. And so then when they walk into class after they learn this, we ask them, what's your stress level as they're walking in? And it's often, high school is a very stressful place. I mean, you remember how it was for us, but
All
it's
right.
100 times worse for them,
Yeah.
with the school shootings and COVID and everything, right? So they're very stressed. So they come in and they're walking in there, they're five, six, seven, eight, sometimes more. And then we ask them that at the end of our class interaction, our 1 hour class of being with the dogs and learning how to do some of the training and learning how to be present for them and how to get peaceful for them. And then we ask them their stress levels. We get over 50 to 60% drop in stress for everyone in 1 hour of interaction.
Is this growing the human animal connection as a field, as a is it picking up? How are you optimistic about where this can go and the benefits and the capacity for this to be adapted worldwide, nationwide?
I am actually optimistic. Our mission is to change or revolutionize how humanity relates to all animals. So that's what our work is for the Human Animal Connection. We just have our book out now. It's just been released, The Human Animal Connection, and that's on Amazon. And we're going to, hopefully get a podcast going in the next month or two to really help you know, people who don't read can learn it from the podcast. So we'll be doing one episode for each of the 33 principles. And we're really optimistic that the world is changing now. It doesn't mean everyone is changing, but if you go back 10 years ago, it was very popular to think that humans needed to dominate their dog, you know, which was a really misinformation based upon misunderstandings of wolf behavior and looking at wolves in captivity where they saw certain behaviors. But in a wolf pack, it's a very harmonious environment and everybody knows their role and everybody cooperates because it's too risky not to. You know, like most wolves, people think of wolves as being violent, but the fact is that wolves know that fights are very costly, that one or the other is going to die in a fight. So they will do everything they can to not fight. They'll do behaviors that indicate aggression. They'll growl, they'll sneer, they'll chase, whatever, but they're not going to actually go into a fight unless they absolutely have to. So wolf behavior is actually much more harmonious, and often the matriarch is the smart one and is the one making choices for the group. So it's quite cooperative. You know, this is herd mentality, and we see this in all herds, you know, that each one knows their role, and there may be little skirmishes or nibbles or kicks or, you know, whatever, growlies or whatever, but it's communication. It's not for violence. And so I'm optimistic that the humans are catching up. And the most important thing that we want people to consider is the idea, if you're just starting to think about these issues, consider the possibility that animals have emotions. They have thoughts, they have feelings, they have desires, they have intentions, they have opinions. And if that's as far as you can go for right now, until the science, I mean, the science is showing that, like the dogs being trained to go into an MRI awake, and they see their brain scans, they see the brain lighting up in the exact same way, or very close to the way that human brains light up. So anger is where it is in a human brain, and fear is where it is in a human brain. And they're seeing emotional responses that are very specific and very complex. And so the recognition that animals have emotions changes how we relate to them, because they're not just dumb robots, you know, they are sentient beings with needs and feelings. And if we can begin to treat them that way, that begins to make us say, well, wait a minute, is what we're doing in shelters the best, or is there something better we can do? And, you know, my hope is that someday shelters, not only will dogs have the opportunity to have more social interaction time, you know, they need to be in play groups, because what one dog can teach another dog in 1 second would take me weeks to teach that same dog, you know, my human training methods, right? So they need social time just like we need social time. And mostly what they need is an understanding of our principles, the 33 principles of the human-animal connection, to understand what they need emotionally. And that's, you know, what I hope for the future is that more shelters would be able to have programs and people devoted to the emotional well-being of the people, of the animals in their care.
It's incredible how much advancement thanks to researchers, thanks to scientists over the last, particularly the last, I'd say, 2 decades, that we're learning more and more all the time about animals and animal sentience. And it's so inspiring to see that continue to happen. I think the humans' understanding of our relationship to animals is getting to a much better place than it's been for centuries. I mean, there are certainly communities of people, Native American, Indigenous peoples, who have historically had a much more respectful interaction with animals than has existed in many other amongst many other cultures. But I'm really grateful for the many scientists and researchers out there who are helping us learn more and more all the time. Your book and the 33 principles, of course, is equally applicable to people like me who has a dog in the house. I got my little four-legged, right? my little four-legged guardian here. I'm a guardian of hers. Can you give us just an example of how, like, these your techniques and what you've learned can be applied equally? It's a teaser for your book. How people can apply this just in their own home life with pets that they have in their household.
Absolutely. I mean, the book is really written for that. It's written for people who have share their lives with an animal and how they can apply it. So, one story from the book is a client called me, and she had she had two greyhounds, rescue greyhounds. One had passed, and the other was just really grieving. I mean, lethargic. I mean, looking like he was going to die himself, you know. So she got another one, but she wasn't she hadn't fully grieved the one that had passed herself. And so the new one began have, you know, she would take them for a walk out before going to work, and both going for a walk. And then the new one would come into the house and promptly go to the potty right on her rug, you know, both, you know, really messy, right? So she was a very, I mean, you could eat off her floor. She's a very clean person. This was like just freaking her out. And she was like, I can't do this anymore. It was causing her stress being late for work. You know, she was just like, I can't handle it. I don't know why. I just took him for a 40-minute walk and da, da, da. So her, I mean, so she called me. I consult with clients, and so made a house call, and we did a session. And I don't know if you believe in this, but I do animal communication. So I will actually ask the animal, what's going on? You know? And so this greyhound, whose name was Bree, said to me, well, there's no room in this house for me. And she was feeling that the person hadn't, her heart was closed because it was still hurting from the loss of the other dog. And when I explained this to her, you know, she, you know, cried, and she recognized the truth of it. And I said, well, she feels like your heart isn't open to her, so you need to really choose, you know, are you going to open your heart? And she did. She did the right thing. She opened her heart, and she recognized, I mean, she was still grieving, but she realized that she needed to, this dog was, new one was sharing her house, and she needed to really welcome that dog fully, not just, you know, feeding her or whatever. And that changed everything. And 18 months later, there hasn't been an accident in the house. So that came from understanding what the animal was interpreting, you know, hey, there's no room for me here, even though, you know, there was technically room, there was a bed, there was food, whatever, it was walking, but
Right.
the animal could tell that she wasn't really, her heart wasn't open. And once she opened her heart, everything changed in the relationship. So sometimes it's as simple as that. You know, it's like a combination lock. You open it and it just opens, you know. Sometimes it takes more, you know, so every situation's different, but it's really beautiful when you see those kinds of stories, you know.
Love it. That's a fantastic story. So the book is available on Amazon.
Yeah.
And we can find out lots more about you at the humananimalconnection.org. Do I have that right?
Yes.
I do.
Yeah. So it's no spaces. It's the human animal connection.org. Don't forget the, because it'll take you to someplace else in a Japanese site if you just put it in. So the human animal connection.org. And you can sign up for our free newsletter. And that's where we let people know when the podcasts and the Zoom sessions we do will take place. If you're in Tucson, then you can contact us. We're always looking for volunteers, even volunteers who aren't in our area, because we want people to spread the mission. So people who are interested in this methodology and this way of working with animals, we will work with you wherever you are, because we want people working in every shelter. So please join our little army of love.
That's fantastic. Listen, thank you so much, Jeannie, for being with us here today. And you've imparted a huge amount of very valuable information. I really appreciate spending the time with you.
It's been great to be here.
That's it for today, everyone. Thank you so much for your continued support of the podcast. If you aren't yet subscribed, please do so. And I hope you'll give us a rating. That would really help us also. Podcast production and website support. For more information about the show, please visit us at www.theanimalguide.com or send us an email at info@theanimalguide.com. Until next time, all the best to you and the animals in your life.